हरि ॐ सहनावतु सहनभुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवत्सदि गौर भक्तवृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
Page 10, that supreme personality of Godhead is situated in everyone's heart as Paramatma. A wise man who can understand him is eligible to attain perfect peace, not others. Then the Bhagavad Gita 8:2-4. Who is the Lord of sacrifice and how does he live in the body, O Madhusudana? The supreme personality of Godhead said, the indestructible transcendental living entity is called Brahman. Akshara, Aksharam, Brahmam, Brahma, Paramam. And his eternal nature is called Adhyayana, or Adhyatma, the self. Action pertaining to the development of the material bodies of the living entities is called karma, or fruit of activities. O best of the embodied beings, the physical nature, which is constantly changing, is called Adibhuta, the material manifestation. The universal form of the Lord, which includes all the demigods, like those of the sun and the moon, is called Adidaiva. And I, the Supreme Lord, represented as the Supersoul in the heart of every embodied being, am called Adiyagya, the Lord of Sacrifice. So now here is saying, the point is, who knows the Lord is eligible to attain peace. Right? So now here, Krishna is giving how to know him, how to understand him. Right? So now here we're also using a formula that's used regularly, but not as much, or at least devotees haven't seen that it's been noted much, is this adiatmic, adidaivic, adibhautic. In the way of klesha, that devotees will quote it, but it actually applies in everything, in all things, like that. So here is that the soul is adiatma, right? And so what how you say the body is adibhuta, right? Because it's made of something else, and then the demigods are the adidaiva, means here, means it's not the adidaiva, means the demigods. The universal form is the adidaiva, right? In other words, what is the controlling power? There's the individual, there's what they're dealing with, and then the controlling power. Right? Then Adiyagya, he's the Lord of the sacrifice. So all that, you're going to control the energy. What is it for? What is the purpose of that? Right? So that will be sacrifice, and that sacrifice is directed at the personality of Godhead. Right? Does this make sense? So this comes up a lot. In the Bhagavatam, we'll come across it quite a bit.
So in this part, Arjuna is asking the Brahma and Adhyatma. So Brahma is the stage, and Adhyatmika is like, what does the soul do? Can I understand like that?
Well, his nature is Adhyatma. Because you're getting means, in other words, like in the kleshas, it means yourself, your mind, is the adiatma. The problems you get from your own mind. Adibhuta is whatever the living entities. Adidaiva is from the demigods. Right? But here we're only looking at the mind, and how it engages, it itself gives itself trouble, how it, with other living entities, it gets trouble, and how by the situations created by the demigods, it gets trouble. Right? But in here, then, we're talking about we're talking about God, the living entities, and the material energy. So therefore, then the soul is the adiatma, right? Then the material energy that his body's made out of, that has all the different, that's the adibhuta, right? And then the universal form, that's the adidaiva, that's what's in control. So when we get into creation, this comes up a lot. you know, the East States, when it's creating all the different elements and all that, then this will be used.
So this terms, they're always the same.
So it's always the same
terms. Adibhuta is always...
Adibhuta, Adidaiva, yeah.
Yeah, but they, like Adidaiva, we call it the demigods and everything, so it's not...
Well, it's whoever's in control. So the demigods are in control, but the demigods are actually just representing the universal form. So the universal form is in control. Actually, you know, which is the Lord. Right? And we say, you know, that they're the mind, but it's actually it's the soul that is the one, because otherwise mind is just material element. You know what I'm saying? And we're talking about others, so the body is others connected to the soul. You know what I'm saying? It means the body, the elements that the body's made out of is not the soul, so it's something else. Okay? Is that a sense? So we have all these things. You found what you're looking for?
Yes.
Okay, very good. Very good. Thanks.
So now, yes, about the Brahman, you know, I think there are different definitions of Brahman.
Different definitions?
Like here, the Jiva is called Brahman.
The Jiva is Brahman, yeah.
So what are the...
Because in here, Brahman is, you're meaning he's transcendental, though he may not understand it.
Yes.
Right? So that's because we're dealing here with self-realization. So then the understanding the soul is Brahman, then that means he's transcendental. So if he's Brahman, transcendental, means then he belongs with the Lord who is transcendental, right? And he's not part of the material manifestation, which is not transcendental. Right? Does that make sense? So here, basically, what you're doing is dealing with superior Brahman, but you're not identifying the Lord as Brahman because he's a person, but the soul identifying as Brahman because they think that they're a material person, but they're not. They're actually transcendental. So you're not discussing now that you have an eternal relationship with Krishna in a spiritual form, like that. So, like that. And we're not discussing the element that God is Brahman, because he's the source of Brahman. Right? Because otherwise you want to know that he's a person. So our problem is that we think we're a person that's separate from the Lord. Right? So then material nature you're not discussing as Brahman. But then in some of the other points, then it's saying that everything is Brahman. It's just a matter of whether it's superior or inferior Brahman. Right, so the material energy is the inferior Brahman. The jivas are superior Brahman, but they're subservient to the internal potency, which is more superior Brahman. And he is the source of all these three Brahmans, so he is the supreme Brahman. Does that make sense? So you have four levels of Brahman. So here we're just trying to get the living entity to understand that he's transcendental.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Like that. So even though you have all these various aspects of Brahman, Brahman simply means the transcendental substance. Right? So that's what everything is. But the point is where the material manifestation is made from the material energy. Because the material energy is transcendental to... Or say the external energy is transcendental to people's material perception of it, their illusory perception of it. You know, she's not, you know, she's not an illusion who she is. It's the living entities are an illusion, right? So she's on the Brahman platform. She's not. It's our perception that is illusory, right? Now, the other aspect of illusory is that all the manifestations of the material energy, they look like something that's real. They act, they give results, they give experiences, but none of that's actually coming from the material energy itself. So, because of not understanding, we think it is, therefore it's an illusion. Right? So we say illusory manifestations. We're the one in illusion. Right? You know, it's just like, let's say, you go to a theater and they've set up the stage for the drama. So there's a tree there and there's a boat and a car and so many things there. They're not real. But they exist there. You know, there's actually a piece of plywood that's been cut and made into a shape of a tree. Right? And so that's a prop. Right? And what it is for a pastime. Right? They're going to do a drama. So the piece of plywood's real, that has been made to look like a tree is real. That in the drama it gives the effect in your experience of a tree, you know, in relationship to the drama, you know. That's real also. But all that is coming from the Lord. You know what I'm saying? There's a certain shape that God has designated this is the tree form. That gives a particular experience. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? So that's what's happening, is the material energy is being made into all. So that everything here is all props for the Lord's pastime of interacting with the conditioned living entity. Right? But we think, no, it's a real tree. No, it's not. It's a reflection of a real tree. The treeness is actually Krishna, not the dead matter that it's made out of. The spiritual world, that's a real tree, because that's taken that shape for pleasing the Lord. It's not just dead matter that you can turn into anything. You know what I'm saying? It's actually the living entity. So that's why one place Prabhupada says, the soul is the doctor, not the body. We'll say, no, the body is the doctor. No, the body is not. That's just dead matter. The soul thinks, I'm a doctor. Therefore, they identify and behave, and that's why I have a body that looks like that. It's the soul who thinks that I am material energy. Does that make sense? Does that work? Or?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay.
So, this material nature, is it actually our perception?
No, all the things are here.
Yeah.
But that we think that this rock itself, this particular combination of earth, water, fire, air, and ether, is creating the particular experience we get. That's an illusion. No, it's Krishna's potency. The universal form has entered this. Therefore, it gives it that. And it's based on all the forms of the universal form that this rock is therefore following like that.
If we change our consciousness, we can be dealing with the internal potency without geographically moving.
Yes, but it's not that this is not still in a rock shape and not giving the effect, because it is Krishna.
Yeah, we're just seeing something else.
We're seeing it as, you know, desirable, or, you know, while this construction materials are piled up here. Or, you know what I'm saying, like that. You know, so the that is our bias. But the point is that it's a rock and it has a particular quality. That's all from the Lord. Therefore, it doesn't matter if it's a rock or a piece of gold. It's still the Lord. Right? So there's no change in that. So that's the equalness. It's not that you can't tell the difference. So his eternal nature is the self. That means his consciousness, himself, not the... We're not talking about what particular, how that self is manifest. So here, because he identifies with the material, he gets a material form. The spiritual world, then he's, because of his eternal relationship, he manifests the spiritual. Here's the material form, there's the spiritual form. Right? But his eternal nature is servant of the Lord. That's why you can advance in spiritual life without knowing the detail of your specific relationship with Krishna. You know, because whatever it is, it's servant. Doesn't matter who it is. Right? From the blade of grass in Vrindavan up to Radharani, all are servants. So if you understand that, and then there's a mood of that surrender. Right? Vrindavan, it's full surrender. But like in Vaikuntha, it's surrender, it's pure, it's prema, right? It's pure devotion. But there's the element of desiring the four forms of Vaishnava liberation. Right? So it doesn't have the pure unalloyed. Right? So trying to develop the pure unalloyed mood, that can be done. Because that will then, what is the particular relationship? That's a detail. Does that make sense? So it's not so important. That's why Prabhupada didn't put much emphasis on it. So we say we're following the footsteps of the Brajavasis, means we're following the footsteps of that mood of full surrender. Okay, 529. A person in full consciousness of me, knowing me to be the ultimate beneficiary of all sacrifices and austerities, the supreme Lord of all planets and demigods, and the benefactor and well-wisher of all living entities, attains peace from the pangs of material miseries. Right? So he's the ultimate beneficiary of all sacrifice. So ultimate beneficiary, because we're saying is that you perform the sacrifice, some result will come. And that may be for this one or that one within the sacrifice. But the ultimate is Krishna. Right? What the whole, the total ritual is going towards is Krishna. So there may be many steps on the way. Like we say, you know, there's some, like you're installing the pot, you know, that pot will, so it has a, you know, a establishment and a worship. You know, does that make sense? You know, there's, means you're going to set up the paraphernalia, there's going to be a way of establishing and worshiping like that. So you'll do some Vandavide and Prayojan. But then that pot is there because later in the yagya you do a certain other aspect with it. Right, so there's always everything. There's always goals. He's the ultimate goal. When at the end of everything, if it's Krishna, that's the ultimate beneficiary. Right, of all sacrifices and yes.
Sorry. So if we know the ultimate goal,
right,
is it important to know like what's on the way?
What's on the way? If you can be totally focused on the ultimate goal, then basically how much you need to work out, you will do.
That's enough.
It is enough. Just like we were saying before in this one, that there are those who, although not conversant in spiritual knowledge, begin to worship the Supreme Person by upon hearing about him from others. Because of their tendency to hear from authorities, they also transcend the path of birth and death. So one may not have so much knowledge about it, but if one is focused on the Lord, always hearing, you know, about the Lord, then from authority, then it will work, right? But the analyzation is useful in that we may mistake that something that we're doing is connected to the Lord when we actually haven't connected it to the Lord. Does that make sense? You know, so it's like, I'm managing for Krishna, and so management is devotional service, so I go home and I'm managing some new investment that I'm trying to do and this and that, but I may not see a connection to Krishna, but I'm thinking it's devotional service because it's management. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, you know, I haven't gotten it through to that. No, ultimately, because I've made money, therefore I've eaten and I have clothes to wear, so I'll get to the temple and do my service. But I'm not necessarily making those connections. So the connection of that aspect of my life is not that strong. Though, because the ultimate is connected, then it does work. So as long as there's not too much focus on all these other things, then basically it doesn't matter. But if there's a lot of focus on that, then you have to consider, well, is it actually devotion? Does that make sense? So it's how much one is absorbed in it. If somebody's just doing because you're doing it, then, you know, it's just one of the things you do, so you don't really worry about it. Then you could be thinking about Krishna or this or that, but if you're totally into that and this is important and it's practical, then it's good to be able to know the technical connection. Right? Otherwise, one might get distracted, you know. Just because we automatically will think, if I'm doing something, that means that thing itself is always devotional, right? You know, so it means the person is going out on books, right? So he's doing Santikam. Temple's doing some big drive or something, so they're going out and just selling stickers and collecting money, but it's called Santikam. Right? Not fundraising, it's called Sankirtan. Now, the person on the weekend, then himself, he goes to some big concert and sells stickers to make money to take care of his family. It's also called Sankirtan.
Is it really?
That's no, but this is my point. This is my point is that we're selling something and getting money, and because in one instance we're doing it for Krishna, we take it any time that's being performed, it's devotional service for Krishna. It might be, it might not be. That's my point. That's where the analyzation is useful, is because maybe it's not, and then we're getting so much trouble. We're going to this concert that there's 20 other devotees there, and there's a fight over who gets what spot, because everybody's been trained by the same people. So everybody knows where the good spot is, but all 20 of them want it. And so then there's this whole thing there, and it's like, you know, I'm just trying to serve Krishna, and so many things like this, but all like that. But why is there so much material trouble? Material anxiety, because there's aspects of what they're doing that they haven't connected to Krishna. You know what I'm saying? There is some aspects that are, because they're devotees. So naturally, if you talk about it or think about it, it will be connected to Krishna. But there's certain aspects that are not, just because, you know, they're just saying, you know, they're just using that logic that, how do you say? You know, I'm collecting. How do you say? I'm a devotee. I'm collecting for Krishna. So if I'm a devotee and I'm collecting, it's automatically for Krishna. You know, there's somehow or another putting myself. Collection and Krishna, but they're not seeing that some situations it's not necessarily connected and some it is. You know? I mean, in other words, you're going out and selling the stickers for the temple, you're directly collecting money for the temple, so it's directly service, right? But when you're collecting for yourself, it's not directly service. You're going to use it in various things within the family life that therefore will be connected to Krishna. Does that make sense? So it's indirect. But we may not distinguish between direct and indirect. And the problem with, and the thing about direct is, even if we don't understand it, let's say the person is just, he likes making money. So he comes on the weekends and goes out with the devotees and also raises funds for the temple. He may not be thinking one moment it's for Krishna. But he's going with the devotees, so he knows it's for Krishna. But while he's doing it, he's not even thinking it's about for Krishna. But he'll get the benefit of having done it for Krishna, because it is direct. Right? But this devotee, if he's home and he's doing it, unless he's connecting it, it's not connected. Right? So in other words, he's collected the money. It's not connected to Krishna. He just collected money. Now, he uses that to buy some petrol so he can drive to the temple. Now it gets connected. He'll get the benefit at that point. Right? Because then it has actually been connected. You know? Or he bought some food and then, you know, he went out, you know, how you say, they went to the water, you know, water park and all that, like that. So a lot of energy like that. But then still in that same energy from eating, then after that, then they went to the temple. Then he'll get the credit for that. But all these other things he doesn't get the credit for. You know what I'm saying? So, by not understanding that, he gets less credit. So indirect, if you're conscious of it, you're getting credit. If you're not conscious of it, then you don't. Until it finally gets to Krishna. You know what I'm saying? Like that. So there, or he's, you know, taking a bath nicely, or a shower nicely, because he's going out to dinner with somebody like that, but on the way, you know, he happens to drop in at the temple. So he gets benefit of the bath from, you know, that he dressed up nicely and everything. You know, he came to see Krishna, but at the same time, his motive wasn't that. So he's only gotten that because of going to the temple. But the rest of it is not. It's not that now when he meets whoever he's meeting at dinner, that he's getting the benefit. No, that's just, you know what I'm saying? But if one understands through the indirect that, you know, you're dealing with people, you have to be proper, you know, as a grihasthi, you're supposed to be very presentable, so therefore it's my duty to be presentable, and I'm meeting this person, why, you know. So in other words, you can connect. Does that make sense? Then you'll be getting more benefit. But still, it's never the same benefit as direct devotional service. That's why ultimately everybody, even though they have all the facilities and they're connecting it all to Krishna, they always move into a more, renounced or detached position, because so that they have the opportunity to engage in more direct activities. Because the point is there's only so much time in the day. Or even if it's not, if you have unlimited time in the day, still the activities of indirect won't give the taste of direct. So as the taste for direct devotional activities increases, one will want to reduce the indirect activities to give more time for direct. Does that make sense? It'll automatically come. So that's why you see is in the Vedic culture, then the grihasthas turn into the process. Basically, the difference is the grihastha, you're having to balance all the indirect activities and your sadhana. Right? While in vanaprastha, you just give yourself more opportunity for sadhana. Because it's, you know, greatly reduced. You don't have to put so much effort into making money, or maybe you're making but not expanding things. You know, there's the kids have grown up. There's so many other. There's not as much to do on the family thing. You know, you've repainted the house already 10 times and done the curtains this way. You know, you don't need to do it anymore. You know, you're satisfied with it. You know, like that. So then all that energy that was used before to keep you busy and keep you enthused, and because you're enthused, therefore you're also happy to do devotional activities, then you're happy just being doing direct activities. So you know, make life more simple. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And connecting third parties' activities to Krishna, is it work?
Connecting third parties activities?
Like preachers, you know. We meet people and then we try to connect them, give as much Krishna consciousness as possible, although they're very kind of reluctant.
Means our dealing in it is direct, yeah. Means they're coming in contact with the way of preaching, and that's also direct.
It is also beneficial for them.
It's always beneficial. That the thing about Krishna consciousness is beneficial for everybody. Like, we're sitting here discussing Krishna consciousness, so we see, okay, we're so many persons sitting here. But in the air, there's unlimited, you know, bacteria and everything like that. They're also getting benefit like that. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Yeah. So that's the whole thing. So these are all agyata sukriti, you know. You know, you're in your office and there's a kirtan going on outside your office downstairs on the street. You may not even notice it because you're so absorbed in, you know, whatever you're doing. But you're getting benefit. You know, if you notice it, you get more benefit. If you're inquisitive about what is this, then you get even more benefit. And, you know, I'm saying so that's the thing, is that all this is, the whole Krishna consciousness movement, how much agyata sukriti is there, right? You buy yourself a kilo of rice, right? Now, all that rice is a good chance it's not all from one plant, right? It's from a large variety of plants. So that means you cook that offer to Krishna. All those plants that grew that rice get benefit. You know what I'm saying? So devotional service, its effect on the planet is very great. Effect on the universe is very great. We don't necessarily see it, because for us it's just kind of like commonplace. You know, that's the power of the Acharya. He's made something that's actually very unique, just like almost like ordinary. You know, yeah, everybody's a devotee. Like that. Does that make sense? You know, so everybody's getting some benefit. So everybody's getting some benefit. I mean, it's just so all that builds up. So what you're saying about agyata sukriti is you have all these things are there, and then eventually that comes up into wanting to know, you know, something more about, you know, what is the reality. Then you come in contact with the devotees and you take advantage of it directly. You know, then that can develop shraddha, faith. But otherwise, before that, it's all these opportunities. So the devotees are creating so much opportunity. Okay. The Lord of all planets and demigods, in other words, everything that's going on is by His control. So one is all planets, means all situations that you're in, right? Because you have 14 planetary systems. So all those, he is the Lord of all that. So it's all running according to his direction, right? And all the demigods who therefore manage that, you know, or the planets being your primary planets that have the influence on the living entities, that is taking care of their, you know, the results of their previous activities. He's the Lord of that, right? And the benefactor and well-wisher of all living entities. So he is working for everyone's benefit. But if we think that, you know, God doesn't like me or something like that, then you have a problem, right? But he likes everybody. It's just that if you do something wrong, just like a parent, you do something wrong, you get punished. It's not that they don't like you. You know, so if the karma seems to be very bad, you were really a bad boy, you know, like that. Does that make sense? So that's the okay. So the whole idea is that Paramatma is the Lord of sacrifice, so everything is directed at him. Someone who knows this and knows him, then he actually can be, you know, peaceful like that. Okay. Yeah. Also, by the note here is that we're dealing with both matter and spirit are as energies. So the soul is transcendental, so he's the Adi Atma. While the material energy is the Adi Bhuta. So they're all being mentioned. But focus on the purport of Bhagavad Gita 15.18. Now it is clear here that the living entities and the Supreme Personality of Godhead are individuals. Notes. The theme of the eternal individuality of the Lord and the living entities is stressed throughout the whole of the Bhagavad Gita. So then, here, 2.12. Never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. Right? So he's trying to bring out that the eternality of individuality. It's not that sometimes you're an individual, sometimes you're not. You know? Does that make sense? You know, you're thinking, yeah, I'll go, yeah, it's, you know, been avoiding it for so long, talking with this person and all that, here's my opportunity. Then you walk over and sit down, and then suddenly your individuality stops and you merge into the chair. There, like that. Is somebody here? You know, so no, it doesn't, you know. And then after they leave, then punk, you pop out again. Oh no, they're gone. Oh no, it's like that. You know, it's like that. It doesn't, no. They're always individual. 4.5. The personality of God had said, many, many births both you and I have passed. I can remember all of them, but you cannot, O subduer of the enemy. So individual here, God remembers. So that's why he reminds you of something. You were doing something last life you were so much into like that. And so this life, this situation comes up, and you couldn't care less because you've forgotten about it. So because that's something you've been doing, then Krishna reminds you. And then it's suddenly, wow, hey, where has this been in my whole life? You know, all these different things like that. There's always been it, just it wasn't time for you to remember.
Why he bothers?
Why he bothers?
I mean, it's like a huge database. And he has to carry it kind of on top of his mind.
No, but for him it's not a problem. Like he said, it only takes a spark of his splendor to manage the material world. So that's nothing much at all. I mean, you look at it, somebody's done something for Krishna, right? Now, you know, an eternal amount of time later, Krishna still remembers that. Right? So that's the good side of it, right? Or rather, he forgot. You know, you came and dressed him so nicely today, and then tomorrow you come and, yes? You know, I'm the guy that dressed you yesterday. Yeah, so? Right? You know, so, you know, he remembers everything. Because there's nothing to forget. He is everything, so what's to forget? Right, that's why he's in his own category, right? Yeah, so.
No, because
the
Christ would make him remember everything. Kind of too much. They have to forget something.
There was a movie, Bruce Almighty, did you ever see it? He wanted to be God. And then everyone was praying to him, and he was going crazy because he could hear everyone praying to him. So he said, okay, I'll get it all be put on the computer. So then the computer was filling up with everyone's prayers, and he was trying to deal with it all.
But at the same time as this, it means you accept this as a principle. Yeah? And it's a good principle, right?
Yeah,
okay. No, I'm saying that's okay. Sometimes consider how your husband would also really like this principle to be applied. Why does she remember everything?
Forget it.
Huh? Yeah. Does that make sense? You know, it says, 10 years ago you did something wrong. You did something wrong. And then he does it again after 10 years. You always do that. Right? Same principle. Reverse engineering. No. So the point is that because of this, he's trying to please the living entity. Let's say like the child was doing something, and now they're doing something else, because when they're playing, they move around. But there's some toy or something like that they really liked before. So you might remind them of that. And then they get back into that again. Right? Or if not, then they move on to something else. Okay, then you don't bring that up again. So Maya is like something you were into, then Maya will bring that up again. And if you're not interested, then she'll drop it. But as long as you're interested, then it's a good medium for making you miserable.
So it means she's dropping it, not us. Like we just
It means only when we drop. The reason she deals with it is because we're dealing with it. If we're not interested in it, why will she harass us? You know what I'm saying? It means if we couldn't care less about what particular kind of chair, ergonomic, wood or not, or whether it's some modern, contemporary, some old chair, is in the, third floor back room of the English department in Oxford University, she's not going to bother us about it. Right? But the professor who sits in it every day, then it's a great botheration for him. Because that's where his attachment is. So therefore, that's where she bothers him. But she won't bother you over that. It comes out in the newspaper, headlines, chair change. The English department like that. It's kind of like, so? But for him, it's like, victory. Does that make sense? So that's the thing. She only bothers me. If it doesn't bother, like I take this and I drop this. Do you care? No. Now, what if that was something, your I was going to say your Swarovski crystal bracelet or something like that. You know what I'm saying? So then, is there a different? Why? Because you're attached to that. You're not attached to this. It doesn't matter. Otherwise, why is it, I think it was in Azerbaijan, about the time of the, when the last big San Francisco earthquake happened. It was like, I forget what it was, 25,000 people died in Azerbaijan. And in the newspapers, it got, that standard on, in the news on the side there, there's one sentence of all the different things like that. Jack and Jill fell down the hill and 25,000 people died in the earthquake in Azerbaijan. It just goes down the page. But 56 people only died in the San Francisco earthquake. But it was like in every major publicity, it was full articles, the main article that's on the cover.
Front page?
Yeah, the front page article, so many pictures, this angle, that angle, this car like this, that car like that, so many things like that. It's just on and on and on and on. Why? Because, those who run these magazines and their audiences are attached to that and couldn't care less what happened somewhere else. We think, wow, that was bad. Does that make sense? We think World War, I say World War II, the Great War, it's like that. So many millions of people, I think more people died in World War I, right, than World War II. But even there, it's like 20 million people die or something like that. But, you know, some of these Chinese revolutions, 70 million people die, you know, nobody blinks an eye. It's pretty standard. But we don't think of them as something really great war. It's just, oh, that was some little revolution. No, that was more people died there than the whole of Europe fighting with each other. You know? Does that make sense? So the whole point is Maya, therefore, only bothers you where your particular interests lie. Because the only reason that you're in the situations you're in is because of your attachments. Your attachment, so you've done an activity, that's produced the result. Right? But if you haven't done the activity, you don't get the result. So any result you get means you have performed the activity before to get it. Right? So if you're there and everybody's harassing you and so much politics and how come nobody will leave you alone and all that, because in the past you've made all the politics. So now it's just, here's the result. You made the politics, now you get the politics. It's easy.
Well, we can see that we advance from something we're attached to. For example, we both just bought it.
Yeah, but not that we've replaced it. You know, it's like, you know, we were totally into skiing, but now, you know, that's stupid. Now we're into boogie boarding or, you know, some, you know what I'm saying, or bungee jumping. It means that before we were so much into extreme sports, and now we're not actually so much into extreme sports. We'd rather, you know, do something. We'd rather chant our japa or go to the kirtan. But if it's, yeah, we're not so much into extreme sports, but we're into something else now, you know. You know what I'm saying? It's not that it's replaced. It's a matter of those things are reduced, and you'd rather be doing something Krishna conscious. Then that's how you can tell. Yes, then that's advancement. Like that. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur recommends that one occasionally reviews all that and sees where, you know. He said, like a codicil, you know, you're not eating, so you might as well do something, right? So, worrying about lunch, you know, think about, you know, are we making advancements? You know? Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay, 13:23-28. Yet in this body there is another, a transcendental enjoyer, who is the Lord, the supreme proprietor, who exists as the overseer and permitter, who is known as the super soul. Right? So here there's you, and then there's another one in this body. Right? So there's the individuals. One who sees the super soul accompanying the individual soul in all bodies, and who understands that neither the soul nor the super soul within the destructible body is ever destroyed, actually sees. Right? So that means it says in all bodies. Because in the beginning we might start to see in some body, okay, we can see it, the super soul and, you know, the cow, or this one or that one, you know, so something like that, or maybe, you know, in something else. It's not really, that doesn't have any particular attachments or repulsions, you know, but whether, like, let's say on our own family members we see the super soul, or that person that's making all that politics against you, we see the super soul, you know what I'm saying? But if you always see, right, then that's actually seeing. Because then you understand it's just the modes of nature. That's all. It means it's the souls there. They're not actually making any trouble for you. They're just the medium for the trouble. Right? You know, they happen to have that kind of mentality, so they're involved in this situation where the modes of nature are doing it. So you'll attribute it to them, but it's actually the modes of nature. And the reason it's happening is because of your attachment to those things, so therefore you're put in that situation. Does that make sense? Like that. Then one always sees. Then one's not disturbed. Like that. Because what's to disturb you? It's just the modes of nature. So it's nothing to be bothered by. Like that. We're bothered that somebody's doing it. No, but the modes of nature are doing it. So it's, in other words,
if somebody is doing something wrong.
It's not a matter of protesting or not, because then that throws it into, you know, being good and nice and all that, because then again you're back to that Brahman understanding, but not necessarily seeing it on the Brahman platform. So it's just pious. What we're talking here is that he may not protest, but it might be he does protest, because the point is that the situation is there, someone's doing something maybe they shouldn't be doing, but the point is we have our duties, and they have their duties, so if the duties aren't being done properly and you're in a position where you can do something about it, why you wouldn't protest? But it's not because they're doing something to you or this or that. It's that these duties aren't going right, and Krishna says in the Shastra should go like this, so for the service to Krishna it's not proper. You know what I'm saying?
In order to see the super soul, we need to have a transcendental vision.
To see the super soul, yeah, means we have to be seeing with this. That means, in other words, when we're seeing through the philosophy, right? Then that will work. If we're not seeing with the philosophy, we won't see the super soul, because super soul is dealing with all the action and the reaction,
yes.
Right? It's he's sanctioning everything, right? So the Lord's entered everything. So that's why everything works. Because the super soul's entered it. That's why it's attractive.
It is the same thing to see the soul through the philosophy.
Yeah, through the philosophy. Because the point is we're trying to get to the point of seeing Krishna. So we're doing these activities just so that we can detach ourselves from the regular working in the material world, where we think that the material world has substance in its own and is something, you know, interesting and exciting, you know, or something to offer of value. But it's actually not. It's just dead matter that, because of the presence of the soul and the super soul, therefore everything's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The soul wants something and the super soul arranges it. So, but it's just... Does that make sense?
Yes.
You know, it's like the child can't walk around much, but they want to go over there. So the parent takes them over there, but in their mind, they got over there. They're not worrying about it, you know, I want to be independent, I don't want to walk over there myself. You know, it's not that they don't care. You know, they're happy to be. You know what I'm saying? So the principle is not a problem. So just because we might think, well, because I thought of it, but I want to do it myself, you don't have to do it yourself. Because we're not doing it now. Just because you think you're doing it yourself, then that's all you require. Because in fact, it's not a matter if I believe it, then you're not doing it. But if I don't believe it, I actually am doing it. No, it's a matter of you're never doing it, whatever you're understanding. But the point is you think you're doing it, therefore you're satisfied. You're happy enough with that. You know what I'm saying? So the point is that the modes of nature are carrying it out. So as long as you're involved in that whole process, you feel satisfied. So now, if that's done in connection with the Lord, then that will give the proper satisfaction. If it's not done in connection with the Lord, then it's not going to give much satisfaction. Hmm. Yeah.
Super soul mentioned here as a transcendental enjoyer. He enjoys his own pastimes. It's 13:23.
Oh, there's another transcendental enjoyer. Means he's actually the enjoyer. You know? So it's not that he enjoys, you know, what the living entity is going through, but he has his own pastimes, and he's actually the one who is the enjoyer of all these sacrifices. You know, he's the enjoyer of everything. So it's actually ultimately meant for him. So he is a transcendental enjoyer. We're not. You know, as an untranscendental, you know, we're not an enjoyer at all. So that's the fun part. We try to say that we are, you know, like that. But we're not actually. But at the same time, as the soul in connection with the Lord is an enjoyer, but a smaller, subservient enjoyer. So the real point is that when the subservient enjoyer connects himself with the supreme enjoyer, then we become happy. But that means then the jiva is also on the transcendental platform. Because when he's not on the transcendental platform, he'll never really be the enjoyer. Right? There's situations that the difficulty is removed, so he'll call that happiness. But it's not actual enjoyment. It's not positive. Because it's not based on the interaction. It's removal of the pain or something. So it's always dealing with the impersonal platform, we're dealing with the functioning of the material world. So this particular function is what I want to remove. You know, but it's always done in relationship to other living entities, but are actually dealing with it as impersonal. You know, that's the fun part. You know what I'm saying? You know, the person, they say he's very personal because he's nice to everybody and that, but he's just nice. He just manifests niceness. And you happen to be there, but if you weren't there, he'd still be nice. You know what I'm saying? So there is, that's the point, is that the living entity, the conditioned state, is always functioning on the impersonal platform. But it may be pious impersonal or impious impersonal. So impious impersonal is said not to be good. The pious personal is said to be good. You know, just like pious activity is considered good, impious is not good. Does that make sense? You know, unless you're a teenager, then you try to turn it around. But then, you know, once you finish school and go to get a job, then you figure out that, no, you have to do all those things that you were supposed to do. So you just wasted 10 years of your life practicing doing stupid stuff, rather than you would have been way ahead if you had been doing the right stuff. But whatever, they figure it out. Then next part of the purport. The difference is that the living entities, right, because they're always individual. The difference is that the living entities, either in the conditioned state or in the liberated state, cannot surpass in quantity the inconceivable potencies of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So in either state, the soul can't, because otherwise then it means you're a gross materialist and he doesn't understand God at all, so he'll think he'll be equal to God in his conditioned state. Those with more knowledge understand that the conditioned living entity is not manifesting really much quality, it's all by the modes of nature. But then they'll make the mistake thinking that the liberated soul will then be equal with God. Right? But the point is that whether they're conditioned or liberated, they will never be equal to God in quantity. Qualities, there'll be so many that are common. So it means God has unlimited qualities, the soul doesn't. But the point is that doesn't matter. It's what you interact on. You know what I'm saying? You have a house in the Bahamas and you have accounts in the Cayman Islands, but you're sitting in some bar next to some guy there and talking. It doesn't matter. You're just talking about this or playing darts on the board or something. That's all that matters for the relationship. You understand? So only those qualities are important. So the interaction with God, those qualities manifest, that's all that's important. So the point is as we surrender, Krishna reciprocates. So however many qualities we have is what Krishna will reciprocate as.
So this is similar that any bhakti process is complete in itself. Any of the
any?
Nine limbs of
It's just complete in itself. But at the same time, they may be used in combinations. Mm. You know, it's just like, let's say you interact with a child. What do you interact on? On all the qualities you have or on the qualities they have?
Yeah.
Right? And it's a dynamic relationship. You get down on your hands and knees and play with the kid. Then it's dynamic, but you're only playing on what qualities they manifest. And you'll consider it a complete, satisfying relationship. Not that all my qualities, you know, I'm also the world's best banker and all that, and this kid doesn't understand that, how can I relate? No, it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. You know what I'm saying? Because for those other things, then he goes to the office and all the other bankers are there, and then they talk bank stuff. Does that make sense? So that's the idea, is that the Krishna reciprocates according to how we deal with him. So it doesn't matter what's manifesting. Whatever's manifesting, that's what he deals on. Does that make sense? So then it's always going to be fine. But in any case, even he deals on those, the qualities he has of that is more. Right? Just like, you know, the grandfather and the grandchild are wrestling. Who's stronger? Right? The 3-year-old or the 6-year-old? Well, it's maybe a bit balanced. You know, like that. But in any case, just for discussion's sake, right? Okay, so we're taking it the grandfather is stronger, right? So, but you know, he gets, you know, pinned down by the child, right? Because that's just part of the relationship. That's what they want to do. It is not that when Krishna's cowherd boyfriends wrestle with him and beat him, that he can't beat them. It's just that that's the mood they went, so that's where he reciprocates with them, and that's what's fun. You know what I'm saying? Because there's nothing to accomplish. Now, when we're talking about grandparent and grandchild, is there anything to accomplish? Anything to get done? No, parent and child, there may be something to get done. So you don't necessarily see that as much. With the grandparent, there's nothing to do. You know, there's absolutely nothing to accomplish. So it's just pure pastime. So we can see when you're dealing with pastime. So God has nothing to do. So he can just have fun. It doesn't matter that, you know, how he's dealing this one and that one, who wins the wrestling match and who doesn't. It doesn't matter. It's just the interaction. Right? So that's how you can understand. He must be the supreme because he has nothing to do. Everybody else has a job, right? Yeah.
The next thing he's killing a demon, right? And he always wins.
Huh?
Krishna's playing with the cowherd boy, but the next minute he's killing a demon. And
wins. Yeah, so he always wins. So, of course. Then you can see who is more strong. I mean, because you see, like, the Nakasura, they just pick him up, like, by 1 foot and swing him around and throw him up in the top of a tree, right? You know, so it's, you know. You know, it's not like, you know, sitting there like this, you know, like that. No, it's just, he only does that if he wants to have fun. You know, then he might do that for a moment, and then the demon will get more enthused, thinks he has a chance to try even harder and all that. And then at the end, when everybody gets too worried, then he just, you know, I think it was Hiranyaksha, right? You know, they're huge, huge people. That means when they were born, they grew up to the heavenly planets. They're that big, you know, from here to the heavenly planets, you know. So, but, you know, then when he's fighting with him, is that he's going and they're just having a thing and it seems equal match. And so then the demigods are getting worried that maybe Vishnu's not going to win. So then at that point, then he's okay, and he gives him a kick behind the ear and kills him, right? You know, that's it. Okay. Arjuna, Bhagavad Gita 10, 12 to 15. Arjuna said, "You are the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the ultimate abode, the purest, the absolute truth. You are the eternal, transcendental, original person, the unborn, the greatest. All the great sages such as Narada, Asita, Devala, and Vyas confirm this truth about you. And now you yourself are declaring it to me. O Krishna, I totally accept all that you have told me. Neither the demigods nor the demons, O Lord, can understand your personality. Indeed, you alone know yourself by your own internal potency. O Supreme Person, origin of all, Lord of all beings, God of gods, Lord of the universe." So here he's pointing out that on this point is that there's no comparison between the living entity and God on volume of qualities. Right? But relationship is established on common qualities. But God's is always unlimited, while ours is not. Ours is not. So no one can know Krishna. Krishna even knows himself only through his internal potency. Right? Because his qualities, his glories manifest through the internal potency. You know, then you can see them. Like how great Krishna is, or how beautiful he is when the internal potency manifests them. Right? So even he only knows. That's why he looks in his own reflection. Then the internal potencies manifest that, then he can appreciate it. Right? So even he's amazed. So that's the thing.
That's good.
Right. You know. This is the thing. You can be amazed by your own qualities, and it's not illusion. You know, like that. You know.
That's why God chases.
Yeah. At thousands of mouths and going on since eternity, and he hasn't finished and never will. Right? You know, it's not like he's only going to be doing this up to, you know, 5,293, and then after that he ran out of glories. So we'll have to think of another example, right? You know, no, it's going to be going on forever. Wow, 10,000. I mean, you think of 10,000 years. Like we're taking, say, 2012. That'll be 12,012. That's a long time. We're thinking it's been a long time, the last 2,000 or 3,000 years, right? You know, 4,000. keep it. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, that's another 10,000. So that's plus this. So 12,000 years, you know. You know, and we're talking back there. Yeah, 2,000 years, you know, the Acharya came and preached and people are still going. So then, in that time, they're talking about 10,000 years ago, the Acharya came and preached, you know. Pretty far out.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, just talking about big. Bhagavad Gita 11:36. Arjuna said, O master of the senses, the Lord becomes joyful upon hearing your name, and thus everyone becomes attached to you. Although the perfected beings offer you their respectful homage, the demons are afraid, and they flee here and there. All this is rightly done. Right? So everybody's means he's the greatest. Like that. You know, in other words, it works, because Krishna is the greatest. You know, as a term, it works. So if someone else uses I am the greatest, it works, because of, you know, it's just a small part of... Does that make sense? Yeah. Everyone's just representing some potency in Krishna.
Mm.
Okay, then continue with the purport. The word loke signifies in the Paurusha Agama, the Smriti scriptures. Oh, actually, the word loke signifies in the Paurusha Agama, the Smriti scriptures. As confirmed in the Nirukti dictionary, lokyate vedharto nena. The purpose of the Vedas is explained by the Smriti scriptures. Right? So the Shruti is giving the Vedic knowledge. But the purpose is explained in the Smriti. Right? It means what is the mantra, what is the ritual, you know, what is the metaphysical definition and all that, but it's the Smriti is the purpose. Notes. Paurusha Agama are scriptures such as the Vaishnava Puranas that directly describe the Purusha, the Supreme Person, as the Lord of Sacrifice. Srila Vyasadeva extracted the Paurusha Agama from the original Yajurveda so these scriptures could be specifically chanted during sacrificial offerings. They are known as Smriti, that's that which is to be remembered, because they help the priests engage in sacrifice. The priests engaged in sacrifice remember the Lord to whom they make the offerings. Because otherwise, they're chanting the Vedic mantra, they're doing the ritual according to the Brahmanas of the Vedas. But to remember the Lord, then they draw from, you know, these Puranas and other texts that then remind them of the personality. Right? So here, from the Vayupuran 6:16-18 and 21 and 22. Originally, there was only one Veda, the Yajurveda. Vyasa divided that single Veda into four. And he also divided the sacrificial duties so that the Vedic sacrifices were conducted by not one, but four priests. Okay, he'll go with the priest now. Vyasa assigned the text of the Yajurveda to be recited by the priest known as Advaryu. He's the one that sets up the sacrifice. He arranges everything, sets it up, he builds the fire. Right. Once the fire is built, then, in the same way, the Hota priest recited the Rig Veda. Right. So then the Rig Veda priest, he's the Hota, or the one who performs the sacrifice, pours the offerings into the fire. He calls the deity into there. Like that. The Udgata priest recited the Samaveda, because Samavedas are the prayers and that. So once the deity has come, then the Udgata sang the prayers. And the Brahma priest recited the Atharva Veda. O best of the Brahmanas, at that time Vyasadeva, who perfectly understood the accounts of the Puranas, took the stories, conversations, and poems of that original Yajurveda and compiled the Puranas and histories. Therefore, the Puranas and histories are parts of the original Yajurveda. So here, sometimes it's also mentioned as the original is the Atharva. Atharva meaning that it's everything together. So you could take it that all of it together is called the Atharva, like that. Prabhupada quotes one place where he uses Atharva. Another place he quotes from this, that it's Yajur. So, but Yajur is the Veda by which all the activities are arranged and everything like that. Right? Does that make sense? So here is that the original stories and conversations of the Yajurveda, that's what's being expanded upon in the Puranas and the histories.
So,
yes.
It's indicated that all the Purana have been given by Vyasadeva.
Yes. Means, in other words, all these histories are there, but he documents them into these specific, compiles them into these specific books. Otherwise, all the stories are there, but he puts them together into these Puranas. Because otherwise, it's the history of the universe, so it means all the history is there. It's just a matter of it being compiled.
And why it's different Shruti and Smriti?
Because there's expansion on it. It means he's taking the stories of there and then expanding on those. Because in those stories there's more aspects and other aspects, or bringing out aspects.
So in the Vedas originally they were just mentioned? These are the
details. No, it's also stories. It's also stories. Means we'll get around to it at some point. In a few years we'll go through, you know, each of the Vedas.
Because we always got the impression that the Vedas are more dry.
No, it's not so much dry, it's the language they use is very intellectual. Like that, you know, it means like... It has that aspect, but even it has the Upanishad, it has the metaphysical, it has the ritualistic, all combined together. Because generally you're used to, the Smritis, generally you get one or the other. But this is all at once, you know, the steeds are, you know, like Indra's white horse. The steeds are running away, and they're thereby washing away, all that is bad in the world. What does that mean? You know what I'm saying? That's how the Vedic language works. You know, but then those steeds, the activity, washing away through relationship, through rasa. All these different things like that. That's what's all coming. But it's done in this way that you can take it and basically do whatever you want with it. There's an actual purpose. That's what Vyasadeva gets. That's Vedanta. That's actually what those verses are meant to define. But you could come up with, you know, Shankya, or, you know, how you say, Nyaya, Vaisheshika, all these different things from those verses. And so therefore you'll interpret it that way. You know what I'm saying? You interpret, oh, this means household. And that mantra is talking about, that's the mantra that when the husband puts the sindur on the wife's forehead. Right? You know, so. But, because it uses the word, I think, sindur or kumkum or something like that. So that's all. That's how they connect the Vedic verses. It has a word. And so then that's used in the ritual. Like yogurt. Oh no, I was thinking of the, I'm combining two of them. I'm thinking of the one for yogurt. Yogurt is talking about the white horses, because they use dadi kravya. So dadi is yogurt, so white like yogurt. Indra's horses. So therefore, that's the verse used when you deal with yogurt. Right? And the sindur one will be something to do with red. So like that, they're very obscure. And generally speaking, Nirukta means, because he's probably quoting from Nirukta here. The Nirukta dictionary, Lokyate Vedarto Nena, the purpose of the Vedas explained by the Smriti scriptures. So Nirukta is how to understand the obscure meanings. Right? Means it's what is the obscure meaning, the hidden, ununderstood. That's the meanings that they're generally referring to. Classical, you'll generally use, it'll be generally more direct, or if it's indirect, it's poetically indirect. You know what I'm saying? It's like that romantic element of indirect. It's just, you know, the beauty of the forest is just like a young bride in its freshness, and, you know, like that kind of a thing. So it's basic, obvious what you're trying to say. But in the Vedic, it's not obvious what you're trying to say. So the obscure element. Does that make sense?
Would that be called esoteric?
Yeah, esoteric. That's the Aranyakas. It's the esoteric. But then you have the philosophical. That's the Upanishads. That's the Vedanta. But then you also have the ritual, which is the Brahmanas. So all those three are, you know, coming out in the text. Like that.
Actually, here it talks about four priests.
Right.
At other times it talks about different professors who are in charge of different Vedas. Is that a different?
That's a different thing. That was just who the different branches of Vedic knowledge were given to, you know, to cultivate and everything. But it's just in the ritual itself, you need to use these.
This is a specific application.
Yeah, it means a specific duty. Someone has to be the host. Someone has to set up. Someone has to, you know, take care of the fire and all that. Someone has to be chanting the mantras. Someone else has to be, you know, actually making the offerings. And then its idea means if it's smaller, then those three are enough. If it's less than two, then that the person offering, the person chanting. Or if there's only one, just the person that's doing the sacrifice. But then he's responsible for the chanting and the setting up and maintenance. But if it's bigger, then you have someone who's overseeing that the other three are doing that properly. Right? And then you can, if it's really big, you're going to have the fifth person, the acharya, who's seeing that those four are doing their duties right. So a Bali Maharaj, and there they have acharya. A Sukracharya was the acharya. Right? And then you have so many other priests that each one is managing it. Right? Does that make sense?
That's going to be. When you go small, when you say there's only one person, in one part of the jagat, there's that bunch of grass that's tied together that represents the priest?
That represents the Brahma priest. So in other words, you have the three other priests and you have the Brahma priest. Kushamai Brahma. But it's a bit too esoteric for devotees to sit around while you go over there and worship a stack of kusa grass. So generally, even though it's there in the ritual, we don't do it. Right there. Because as it is, then, you know, it gets a bit lengthy. Okay. So, two. The Mahabharata Adi Parva 1.268 states, whoever approaches the Vedas without first studying the Smriti, Itihasas and Puranas, frightens the Vedic knowledge away. Because you don't know what it's for, so therefore they're going to get worried. What are you going to do with that? Like that. And seeing that this is using some very serious Sandhi here and less Samas, I'm going to not read the Sanskrit.
Looks interesting.
Yeah. Now you can understand why Germans were first so attracted by Sanskrit. The words are as big as their words, you know.
Amount of consonants after each other.
Yeah, yeah. It means the what do you call it? The handle for rolling down the window on the back left side of a car with four doors. That's the one German word, right? You know, there's a, so that's what they like to say. Three, Sattva Tantra, right? 3:41-48 explains that only those who have faith in devotional service, bhakti nishta, understand the Parusha Agama. They know that Sri Krishna, whose form is of pure goodness and who resides in the spiritual world served by his devotees, is the supreme absolute truth. Those who have faith in speculation, jnana nishta, follow the Upanishads. They say the highest truth is the impersonal Brahman. And those who are karma parama, devoted to pious deeds, follow the three Vedas. They say the supersoul, Hiranyagarbha, is the highest truth. No, according to Bhagavad Gita 6.3, the mystic yoga system includes karma yoga in its aruksha, or beginning phase. At the arudha, or advanced platform, karma is given up and the yogi simply meditates on the Lord in the heart. That's why you can also count yoga in karma. So by just saying karmis and jnanis, you can cover everybody, because the yogis are included because they're karmis. You know, their process includes karma in the beginning, in the first six stages. The last six are just meditating, right? But then we see the result they go after generally is that of the jnanas. Mm. So they just switch from one to the other. Mm. Therefore, Srimad Bhagavatam 1-11 states, learned transcendentalists who know the absolute truth call this non-dual substance Brahman, Paramatma, or Bhagavan. So, therefore, from studying the Itihasas and Puranas, you actually understand the purpose of the Veda. Then when one studies the Veda, then you won't have any problem because they won't run away. Maybe that's why nobody studied them up to now, because they'd go running off. Put the book down, turn it around, and gone.
Is it the personalists who don't want to study the Vedic?
Yeah, they're the main ones. But you also have some of the really strict karmakanda people. They don't either. They don't like Arya Samaj, some of these other, they don't accept. So you have both in the karmis and jnanis, those who will only accept the Vedas, and they won't accept the Puranas and Itihasas. Like that. So that was where that's where that significance comes up, when there was that story where Bhaktisiddhanta was invited to a debate. It was with these kind of persons who only studied. Basically said, you can't quote from the Smriti, only from Shruti. And he said, fine. And then I think, okay, then there's a lot of quotes in Upanishads that Vaishnavas use. So they said, you can't quote from the Upanishads, only from the Samhita and the Brahmanas and like that. And he said, fine. And then they got worried and canceled the engagement. he'll just quote Vedic text and establish, no Upanishads, and still it's established. So, because we see here is that the whole point of the Vedas is to know Krishna. It's just they're using that Vedic language, that people could understand that or not. But even if they don't understand it, at least they create a favorable environment in which the devotees could function. Socially, it's there. Like philosophically, maybe not.
Om Hare Krishna 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 Hare Hare, Hare Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
Now, just a thing, has anybody ever noted that this Parusha Agama? Have ever heard of it, heard anyone talk about it? But that's right in the purport. Right? And then, besides that, then you get, three quarters of a page of quotes from Puranas and Itihasas and that bring out the point that is being made. Right? That's was Sahotramar's scholarship. Yeah. he was a real scholar.
I heard that he was reading like page in 5 seconds or something.
Yeah, no, he'd sit down and these big fat books like that and read it in one night. He'd just lay down when he'd go to sleep, like light reading material before going to bed, He'd read for a while, go to sleep, and then wake up in the middle of the night and continue reading and then like that. And then by the way, he's finished the book. So I remember going into wherever he was staying, there'd be a stack like this of books. And that was just what he'd read. Then something he'd go back and get the book again and go through it. So sometimes he'd read them many times. So. He was smart.